Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. Let me just start by welcoming everyone tonight, and I'd like to take this opportunity on behalf of the Tattered Cover to thank you for your support of our locally owned bookstore. We really appreciate it. Thank you. Named by The Atlantic as one of the 100 most influential figures in American history and by Time and Life magazines as one of the 100 most influential Americans in 20th century, Ralph Nader's documented criticism of government and industry has had widespread effect on public awareness and bureaucratic power. For more than four decades, Ralph Nader and the dozens of citizens groups he have founded have helped us drive safe cars, eat healthier foods, breathe better air, drink cleaner water, and work in safer environments. He is a lawyer, an activist, a presidential candidate, and most importantly tonight, a best-selling author. Please join me in welcoming Ralph Nader.
Thank you very much. Thank you. You're very kind. Thank you very much. And it's always good to come back here. I have a preference for independent bookstores, obviously. And I'm glad to see this one standing tall as ever, maybe the most prominent one in the country. And so it's good. Although I have trouble remembering its full name. To me, it's just Tattered in Denver. Well, this is my first work of fiction. And as I said just a moment ago, it may be my most important book because it's not a novel. It's what's called in the literary world a practical utopia, which means it says, what if XYZ was in place, what kind of country would we have? And to take a rather mundane example, if someone said that they wanted to build, that this country should have a steel mill, and they got together $300,000, and it wasn't built. So they got together $500,000 and a designer, and it wasn't built. So they got another $600,000, and they got land for it, and it wasn't built. And then they got a source of iron ore from Minnesota, and it still wasn't built. And they actually got a contract with the railroad to take the iron ore to where the land for the plant, and it wasn't built. We'd understand that, because they had to have a critical mass of resource to have the experts and the people who make the steel mill and design it, build it, operate it, maintain it. They have to be paid. Now, in the citizen movement, somehow we've documented the abuses ad infinitum, bookstores full of them. Never in American history have there been more muckraking books, exposés, every industry, coal industry, copper industry, textile, the Pentagon, Blackwater, you name it. And we've got a lot of writing about diagnosing our problems in our society, proposing good solutions, good policy, and widespread denunciation of the bad guys, Wall Street, looters of pension funds and people's savings. And somehow, we don't go the next step. Even though the citizen movement, which achieved a lot in the 60s and into the 70s, began being overwhelmed by a massive expansion of exactly the kind of resources to achieve an objective that the corporations knew how to raise. The lobbyists, the PR people, the political action committee, the money fundraisers, the threats to the incumbents that they may be challenged in the primary even though they have a safe seat, and the threats to take plants abroad if regulations are enforced for pollution control or water. And so there's been a pronounced stagnancy in the citizen movement as we know it. Call it progressive, call it justice, call it dealing with poverty, corporate crime, globalization, environment. And somehow the mind stopped. The brain in the citizen movement stopped. It was on automatic. Expose, diagnose, denounce, propose. Expose, diagnose, denounce, propose. Come election time, oh, we don't want to support anybody who represents our agenda for 40 years. Why, he can't win. And we don't particularly like the Democrats. And we despise the Republicans. But you got to choose in life. And we'll just go to the polls and choose the least worst. We won't even try to make the least worst better, because we don't want to upset the least worst, because the alternative is worse. And so we'll take off the anti-war movement in 2004, which was building up to a wonderful crescendo in the latter half of 2003, and all over the world, and not just in Washington and New York, but in smaller cities around the country, as you know. Well, no, we don't want to embarrass John Kerry. In order for him to get elected, he has to out-hawk Bush. He has to say, we want more soldiers in Iraq. And during the first debate, he said, I wouldn't have pulled out of Fallujah, looking at Bush. So after the election, without worrying about the Democrats, Bush blew Fallujah apart. Every 4 years, same thing. In between, expose, diagnose, denounce, propose. Every other year in the four, vote for the least worst. Undermine the candidate that represents your interests. Don't protest when he can't get on the debates. When a majority of the people polled, including Fox Poll, wanted me on the debates in 2000, 2004. In fact, try to undermine him. Denounce him in the magazine of the Progressive. Criticize him in the nation. Because after all, he can't win. Never mind that in 1840 there was a Liberty Party against slavery, and then there were the Women's Suffrage Party and the Farmer, Worker, Labor, Greenback parties later on, and they never won. But there were enough voters who didn't say, well, I'm going to vote for the least worst between the Whigs and the Democrats about slavery. I'm not going to vote for the Liberty Party, which was anti-slavery, the first party on the ballot in 1840. Now you can see I am building up frustration. Out of frustration comes creativity. Okay? So I wrote this book in a period of 9 months, over 2 years. It poured out of my Underwood typewriter. Why did it pour out of my Underwood typewriter? Because every time we lose a battle, I want to learn from my losses, and so I put in my little mental reservoir all the reasons that I could think of as to why we lost in Washington or elsewhere. Didn't have enough resources, couldn't get enough media, couldn't get the key organizers in the right congressional districts, couldn't figure out a better strategy, didn't have influential people to make calls on our behalf to members of Congress who they can't shrug off the way they shrug us off, and so on. And that's what made this book. Now, this book's very compact. It says, big print. I want older people to read this book. Especially older, super rich people to read this book. So this book starts with real people. If you have the book, if you just turn to right at the beginning, you'll see the list, just before the prologue. Warren Buffett, Bill Cosby, Barry Diller, Phil Donahue, William Gates Sr., Joe Gemayel, Peter Lewis, Paul Newman, Yoko Ono, Max Pilevsky, Gino Pellucci, Ross Perot, Saul Price, Bernard Rapport, Leonard Riggio, George Soros, and Ted Turner. Now, here's how it starts in fiction. Warren Buffett is sitting in his living room in Omaha in the aftermath of Katrina. Day one, day two, day three, day four. Terrified families and their children streaming out. No water, no food, no shelter, on the highways. He can't take it anymore. Nobody's helping them. And so he retains quickly a convoy of trucks with supplies and public health workers, and he goes down himself, and he's passing them out on the highway, on the side of the highway. And the word is, the families up further, that there's a billionaire from the Midwest coming to help them. And so he reaches this extended family, and the grandmother was so grateful. She grabs his hands, cries out, "Only the super rich can save us." On his way to Omaha, the words haunt him, and things start clicking from his other activities. He's a man who helped save the estate tax with 1,000 other rich people a couple years ago in Congress. He's a man who went a few weeks ago to Congress and told senators that they should raise the taxes on the very rich like him because he's undertaxed. He paid 16% last year, he said, and his secretary paid 25%. And so there's a predicate for all these 17 people. I don't lobotomize them and start them new. I draw on things that they've done and their expertise, and they all have their own Rolodexes and their own constituency, and they're knowledgeable about this, and someone's knowledgeable about that. So he gets them in a mountaintop hotel in Maui, January 2, 2006. And back and forth they go in total isolation, no emails, no cell phones. And he creates this hour of silence. So they talk for 3-4 hours. They have a delicious Hawaiian meal. And he says, "We will now sit around this table in the atrium, elbow to elbow, and we will not talk for 1 hour. We will think about what we've said, what we were going to say, how we're going to interact, and here's a pad and pencil for each one of you." And they thought he was crazy. They hadn't been used to that. But before the strategies matured in following months, they found that that was extremely valuable. It helped their concentration, and completely different than sitting alone for an hour of silence. So thus began all kinds of creative strategies and tactics as they planned to take on, in 1 year, the corporate Goliaths and their political allies in Washington and turn around the country with the most dynamic, comprehensive grassroots organizing. Organizers, candidates, implementers, lecturers, Congress watchdog groups, tapping into every area. They did not prejudge anything. They hired hundreds and hundreds of lecturers. Like some of you know, that was what started the populist progressive movement. Back they had lecturers go from farm to farm and so forth. And they went to the American Legion, the VFW, the women's clubs, the Kiwanis, Elks, in addition to neighborhood groups and more explicit reform organizations. And to show the scale, they had at their peak 400 recruiters full-time, sifting hundreds of thousands of resumes as they expanded and deepened all over the country. They could do this because they put in big money. And not only did they put in big money, before they finished, $15 billion. This $15 billion is what produced this, the achievements. And that is a realistic figure when you consider the strategies, the fact that they had complete access to mass media, because one of them is Barry Diller, who has control over radio and TV stations, that just bought a whole network like this. Because he has the lawyers, his law firms, he buys and sells and so forth. He just bought a network. How did they get people's attention? All kinds of little clever ways. They had 1,000 youngsters that they were educating in civic experience, be on street corners in downtown business districts, and in the old ways, passing out tabloids, read all about it. Don't you remember? Read all about it. All these people in the 13th and 15th floors are looking down. What's going on here? They're getting under our belly. And then they had a parrot. When they first started, they had to get people's messages. They wanted to build up a huge mailing list. And just to have a kind of wonky one-minute ad on TV, it might not attract attention. So they got a beautiful macaw parrot called the Patriotic Polly. And it started each ad with, get up, don't let America down. This became famous. People would go around saying, get up, don't let America down. This was before, the slogan of President Obama took currency. And so they, February, March, April, they go out on their own. They don't let the country know that they're coordinated with these private meetings in Maui. And they do their own thing. So, for example, Joe Jamail, Warren Bates, are into access to justice. And Jamail put $15 million into various law school clinics to advise people how to use small claims courts up against the credit card companies and the insurance companies and the banks and so forth. And, of course, this enormously provoked the large corporations because they'd never dealt with small claims courts. If they didn't show up with their lawyers, there'd be a default judgment. And if they did show up with their lawyers, there are some states that prevent lawyers from appearing in small claims courts. There was a real hullabaloo about that. But then they started the People's Chamber of Commerce as an alternative to the U.S. Chamber and the National Association of Manufacturers in Washington, because they found, Gino Pellucci's the one who did that one, that there are tens of thousands of small businesses like this one, that in restaurants and so on, and machine shops, and they don't want these two big trade associations speaking for them. So they developed a sub-economy. This has always been one of my favorites. They bought a business in every sector of the economy, or businesses. For example, they bought a fast food restaurant. They bought an insurance agency. They bought a gas station. They bought an auto dealer. They bought a dry cleaning establishment. They would buy a bill collection company. And then they would buy some wholesalers. And the idea is twofold, to get the intelligence back to the 17 and their secretariat as to what the trade associations were planning by way of a massive counterattack. And second, to do best practices and hurl it up against the other companies, it's like sustainable practices and honest practices and so forth. And so the book is full of things like that, little ideas, strategies, tactics that have not been tried because there's never been enough money to do it. You can't take on trillion-dollar industries and businesses and their government allies and the military-industrial complex with a few million dollars. Do you know the majority of the people here? Let me test. How many people here are for single-payer health insurance? Okay. A majority of the people are for it. And a majority of doctors in a poll a year and a half ago, 59%. And an even greater majority of nurses. And quite a few health economists. And yet, there isn't one full-time lobbyist every day going down on Capitol Hill. And it has been taken off the table by Obama, the Democrats, and the Republicans. Now, how can you get single payer with that kind of resource? What if some multi-billionaire and his friends decided they wanted to go down in history the way Tommy Douglas did in Canada? Tommy Douglas was voted the greatest Canadian of them all because as Prime Minister of Saskatchewan, he started the single-payer insurance. So let's say in a kind of taking philanthropy to a level of social action and justice, this book's not about charity and philanthropy. It's about a power collision and taking power from the few to the many around a number of redirections. Let's say 5 or 6 billionaires. We've never had more multi-billionaires and mega-millionaires. They're in the Ozark Hills, and they're worth $2 billion because they did stuff on real estate in Southern California years ago or whatever. Let's say 6 or 7 of them get together, and they say, I think we want history to see us as doing something for the American people other than just piling up money. And we just got a report from the Journal of Public Health. They say to themselves, this is true, by the way, that 45,000 Americans die every year because they can't afford health insurance. And it's a disgrace to the country. Truman first proposed it, and the AMA defeated him. But out of World War II, devastated Western Europe got it for all its people, and we still don't have it 64 years later, they say to one another, and they're getting all revved up, you see. And we'll have doctors on our side, and we'll have very smart economists. And, well, one says to the other, what will it take? And he says, well, you know, we usually know what it takes to make an investment to succeed. You know, we want to build things and sell things. So they come down with a figure. My figure is $1 billion in 1 year with lightning strikes vis-a-vis 535 senators and representatives back in their districts, white hot levels of organization, personal interest stories, marches, media, proposed challenging candidates, fast. 535 men and women who put their shoes on every day like you and I. Can't turn them around with $1 billion? A third of them are already for single payer if there's a private vote. 83 have already signed on single payer, H.R. 676. Now, have you ever heard anybody talk like this? This is what happens. You control people by controlling their expectation levels. And in the citizen movement, we have lowered or kept our expectation levels too low. Therefore, we're spinning our wheels. And we've got to raise it. And we've got to go to these super rich. And we know. And if you read this book, I think three things will happen. One, you'll come out feeling stronger as a citizen. Two, your expectation levels and enthusiasm will shoot up high. And three, you'll never be as inhibited asking super rich people for money. Okay? So, Leslie Stahl read this in 60 Minutes. She read this on her vacation in August and wrote me a nice note saying she found it engrossing, creative, and funny. And I said, I'll take all three. Because that's the way I wanted to write it. There are some very funny scenes here. They had to figure out how to overcome the right-wing talk show yahoos. And so while they were building all over the country, you know, laying the groundwork, hiring people and so forth, and getting a lot of media, huge media, because the media couldn't figure what was going on. You got one guy starting a People's Chamber of Commerce where Oprah was a guest, and you got another guy, he's lawsuits all over the country, and small, you know, all these people are, what's going on here? But they didn't know they were organized together. And so they had to deal with two characters. One is named Pawn Vanity. And the other is Bush Bimbo. So they decided to decoy them and distract them while they were building, because, you know, they were getting ready. The two talk shows didn't know where it was coming from. Like, their advertisers would come in, big executives, you got to get these guys. And Bimbo and Vanity would say, oh, well, we want to get them. We don't know where they are, who they are. How can we accuse them? They're not Nazis. They're not fascists, communists, pinkos. You know, they couldn't label these guys because they were billionaires. They had built a business. You know, you can't red bait them. And so their audience started shrinking, of the two. But Bimbo was desperate. And so he did something he never did before. The great soliloquist, who's afraid ever to be challenged in a debate. In real life, I've demanded to debate him after I called him a corporate welfare king, using our public airways for nothing, freeloading on people. And so he invites Ted Turner into the studio for a 30-minute interview. And That is really one fracas that's in the book. And part of it is funny, and part of it is very informative. Well, I don't want to give, you know, no point giving away too much here. I hope someday it will be a book in government courses. There's a lot of experience in the book about power, how to deconstruct it, how it behaves, how to go after it with different angles where it's not used to responding. They know how to crush a frontal challenge, but they don't know how to, you know, different angles. And I also hope that people will think this is also big enough to be an answer to Ayn Rand. So why don't we open it up? I had breakfast with Warren Buffett two days ago. He had looked into it. I hadn't finished reading it. None of them have responded yet because they want to read it all, and they've been on vacation, Labor Day, all this, you know. And besides, you know, this is, people don't read this much anymore. Now, if you have the book, on page 76 are the seven redirections of their entire agenda, and they have one on economic inequality, health and energy, food and housing. That's under first stage improvements, pillar number one, long overdue. Pillar number two is Congress. Pillar number three is electoral reform. Pillar number four is posterity. They really focus on children and grandchildren. If you focus on their betterment, you're going to improve people who are adults now. They have a pillar on promotions, media, staged events, theater, they have one on credibility groups, veteran groups, civic organizations. They have one on sustainable sub-economies, organizing progressive business groups, breakthrough companies. They have a pillar on access to justice, a pillar on mass demonstrations. They get out increasing rallies in the center squares like Fountain Square in Cincinnati. And Boston, you know, all the older cities, and people would start coming out. First, it was a few hundred. But they got them coming out with free food, music, and aesthetics. You know, Yoko Ono's great contribution was she gave it an aesthetic dimension. Every social justice movement has got to have an aesthetic dimension. And the peak of her contribution was a beautiful logo called the Seventh Generation I that was totally, almost hypnotic. And everyone in the country after a few weeks knew it when it came on. And then number 10, citizen utility boards. It's a little wonky, but it's how they sent out mailings to tens of millions of people and had them choose whether they want to join consumer groups with full-time advocates, taxpayer groups, labor, and voter reform. And because they could afford it, they sent out like 2 billion letters. And with a 1, 2%, 3, 4% return, that's a lot of people. So when the counter attack came, they were ready for them. And the corporate Goliaths hired the Darth Vader character. His name was Lancelot Lobo, a 48-year-old frenzied corporate attorney. I had fun with that one because I had to deal with these corporate attorneys all the years. So I made a composite character. So it's a titanic power collision. But it's amazing what happens in terms of what can be done, the dimensions, the depths, the planning for the future, the lightning strikes to get the legislation through, how they destabilize the 30, 40-year chairs of the House and Senate Committee. You know, they've been there for 30, 40 years, safe district, southwest Oklahoma, nobody ever challenged them. It's amazing what can be done when you basically say they will write the check if it's needed. And not only their check, but after a while, their billionaire friends started saying, wow, look what these guys are doing. They're getting all over the country. Why shouldn't I move from material success to equitable significance, you know? And so they would give, so they would call them up. The 17 were responsible for their epicenter of very rich people, their friends and business associates, retired. These are all in 70s, 80s, and 90s. There's only one who hasn't hit 70, and that's Barry Diller. So when you get that age, you know, start thinking other than just piling up more money. How are you going to answer your great-grandchild's piercing questions? They would call up these rich people, and at first they'd give them all kinds of excuses. Well, you know, I put my money in prevention of tapeworm to children of color in southeast Louisiana. You know, that's my favorite charity. And, of course, the billionaire who's calling him up, who's in 17, he's got all the financial statements of this guy. And he's just lying through his teeth. You see? And one guy said, well, I have a real cash flow problem, Bernie. Well, you know, you don't have a cash flow problem. So they have this kind of dialogue. Well, what happens is Turner's dream in real life, Ted Turney, after he gave $1 billion to the UN, was to form a group of billionaires. So in this book, he forms a group titled Billionaires Against Bullshit. So you can imagine the publicity that got. Thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.